Welcome to the Coconuts Podcast. The Coconuts Podcast delivers impactful, weird, and wondrous reporting by our journalists on the ground in eight cities: Singapore, Bangkok, Hong Kong, Manila, Jakarta, KL, Yangon, and Bali. Listen to headline news and insightful interviews on matters large and small, designed for people located in or curious about Southeast Asia and Hong Kong. I'm Byron Perry.
I'm Vim Shanmugam.
And I'm Samali.
So, as you guys know, we have a lot of live shows that we've launched since the pandemic has begun and everybody's stuck at home. Vim, you've been leading production of those. We got another episode of IsoDate, our live social experiment / reality TV dating show tonight. You excited for that, Vim? What's going to happen? Do you think they're a match?
Yeah. I think we cast them with the view that they would be a match, but you know, you just never know. I think the live factor brings different personalities out in people.
It's an X factor.
Yeah, it really is. Like, you know, they might perform to the camera a little bit, maybe. Or maybe they just like withdraw. We don't know. But I think either way, I think we have two entertaining people tonight.
Awesome. It's so they're so brave. They're so brave to go live on a date. That would be intense.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's funny because for anyone who hasn't seen the first episode, please go check it out. It is on Coconuts TV.
YouTube, yeah.
Yeah, Coconuts TV YouTube. But yeah, I think not many spoilers, but their parents were watching, and you know, one of them made it.
No spoilers, but her dad was watching, and it got awkward.
Yeah, so I think that sort of level, that sort of added like voyeurism, I think it's quite funny.
Yeah, you could visibly see it was funny. She didn't care. She's an actress, Alyssa, so she just seemed like, oh yeah, that's my dad, no big deal. But you could visibly see that the guy, Lionel, was uncomfortable. He was like, wait, what? Your dad is on?
You told your dad you were coming on the show? What?
Yeah.
She was actually like really open and kind of a good, she was a good sport, like I think for the show. So I think hopefully we continue having personalities like that. I think that will sort of, you know, make the show much more entertaining.
Yeah. She was, I think, the perfect personality because she just had I don't want to say no shame, because she didn't really do anything. Well, it is embarrassing in some ways just to go on a date without, but she was not ever shy or embarrassed. Mm. She just took everything kind of on the chin. But again, there wasn't anything too embarrassing for her that happened, other than her dad being on, which I would have been like, call over.
Yeah. Yeah, and for those of you guys like listening at home, this is actually real. Like, you know, I've had a few questions during the week. Are they like talent? Are they, they definitely met each other before? They're like, no one, they don't know each other. They meet each other on the show. So it's literally like a, you know, a blind date that we're all privy to except them. So, I think it's quite funny.
That's why it's so good. And I mean, we're going to have some dates that go really, really well where sparks will fly, and we're going to have some dates that go terribly. And I can't wait for that, too.
I don't know about you guys, but like the comment section is where it's at for me. I was laughing at them most of the time.
Totally. Yeah.
It's such a key part of it. And it actually is what makes it so thrilling in a lot of ways, that you have this live commentary and sometimes the questions get asked to the daters and they respond to them. So that interaction and back and forth and just the live, it's like the peanut gallery. I've told people, you know, who didn't watch it live that they really got, first of all, you really got to watch it live because that's where that aspect of the back and forth and the live interaction is so fun to be involved with. But also, if you are going to watch it after the fact, you got to have the comments going, and it's very, you need to be ready to try and feel like it's live, you know, and sit back, get some popcorn. It's an hour long, so there are, you know, awkward spaces and weirdness, but like with the comments running, which it can run when you watch it after, the comments do replay, that really kind of duplicates the experience of it live, but nothing is better than actually watching it live.
Absolutely.
And then we have 30 Cuisines in 30 Days with Tara in Bangkok, which is super fun. Basically, to rewind, we basically, you know, with everyone being stuck at home, the circuit breaker period in Singapore, Bangkok has been on lockdown, our two main offices, everyone's been at home. Everywhere else, people are pretty stuck at home. We couldn't go out and shoot and produce videos as we normally would do and had planned for this year. And so we had to adapt and launch these formats, which can be done from our homes. And we wanted to try live video as well and really jump into that, because obviously live video is kind of exploding now with everybody being stuck at home. And so another concept that we had, all these concepts had to just be able to be done from your home, you know, with everyone at their respective homes, which IsoDate is. The daters are at home on a video chat. But 30 Cuisines in 30 Days with Tara is a totally different concept, really fun, kind of mukbangy, in that basically Tara, for 30 days, our head of Grove, who is one of the key executives at Coconuts based in Bangkok, runs our Bangkok office, orders 30 different cuisines in 30 days by delivery and just eats them in front of the camera, talks about them, and is really going for a wide variety of food, a wide variety of dishes. She's done Japanese ramen from Bankara, which is one of the most famous ramen places in Bangkok. She's done German / Austrian food from Bay Auto, one of the most famous German restaurants in Bangkok. And so it's really fun. And it's, I think most importantly, it's a really, it's a daily concept. She's doing it every day, 2 p.m. Singapore time, 1 p.m. Bangkok time, ordering and eating lunch in front of the camera. And yeah, that's been really fun to watch as well.
Yeah, I think it's just like playing off the fact that we can't actually fly anywhere. Yeah. Go anywhere. So essentially, we're bringing all the stuff, the food aspect of travel to the household. So that's quite fun. I've enjoyed it so far. Now I'm making a list.
Yeah. A list of foods that you want to eat, or?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I think, like, because we kind of get lazy, I feel, like, at home, and you kind of eat the same stuff, like, every day. Like, it just becomes like a, okay, I got to eat at this time and I'll probably just eat this thing because it's like convenient. But I think maybe challenging yourself to try different cuisines and different food. Even if you just said like, I'm not going to eat the same thing twice in a, you know, like a span of 30 days. Like, I think that might be a challenge in itself. It doesn't even have to be different cuisines. Like, yeah. So I think just to get people sort of, you know, a little excited about changing up their daily meal plans.
Yeah. Some of the other ideas for a title we had were like traveling taste bud tour. Because her taste buds are going on a worldwide tour right now. It's really great.
Yeah.
And then we have our third and final for now live concept, which is Coco Chats, which we've been running for the longest, about at least a month. That's done on Instagram. Instagram has this really now famous format where you can do a two-person live chat. So many big celebs have done it. I think The Daily Show with Trevor Noah has done a lot of really high profile interviews with people. And on Coco Chats, it's very simply an interview and a quick conversation with notable people from around the region. We've done rapper Young Raja in Singapore, who I interviewed. We've done drag queen Pangina Heels, who I also interviewed. And probably our highest profile guest was yesterday, Andra Nasri, our Indonesia managing editor, interviewed Joko Anwar, who is pretty clearly, I think, the most famous and most accomplished Indonesian film and TV director. So that was really popular and really interesting.
Yeah, legendary. One of the legends of Indonesian film and TV.
Yeah, it was funny to hear him. I actually asked the question. I was like, do you want to win an Oscar? I know he probably gets annoyed with questions about like, you know, Parasite, which won the Oscar last year for Best Picture, being like, oh, is Asian cinema now going to have an easier time? Or does Parasite pave the way for more Indonesian films to be more mainstream U.S. and Hollywood fame and success? And he said, well, I don't really care about that. Basically, we have our own amazing film scene. And so, which I thought was cool. And I thought he might say that. I knew it was a little bit provocative because you don't want everything to be U.S. centric. But of course, the Oscars do matter. And probably he would like to win an Oscar. Who wouldn't, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Even if it is but so I think white.
Yeah, Oscar's so white. Although, hey, last year it wasn't, right? So.
Okay, baby steps.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think, like, also in general, like, for TV and film, the biggest thing they always say is knowing your audience. And, you know, yeah. like, I think if you make something great for your audience, the awards will come, you know? Like, and I think that's what maybe Parasite has opened up for people. Just make, you know, the film and tell the story that you want. And if it's great, like, it doesn't matter, like, what language it's in or, you know, who's in it. Like, you know, I think that's probably what Parasite broke down more than anything else.
Yeah, totally. Even that subtitles are worth reading to enjoy the film.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it totally is. Yeah.
That was a whole thing. Like, I saw some Americans complaining, I don't want to watch this movie because I have to read the subtitles. For a really good movie, you don't even have to read the subtitles. What? So just dumb. So you can't read, dude.
Yeah. I apologize.
Admit that you can't read.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I think that's a huge, that's kind of why I asked that, because I believe that Parasite has really broken down the doors to mm-hmm. opening people to, like, considering film and TV from outside their country more, and film and TV where they might have subtitles and have to read it, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm excited for that because, and I think Netflix is a huge part of this. You know, there's yep. been shows that have gone really huge globally. Like, I think Money Heist is one of them, which is in Spanish. I haven't watched that, but,
amazing what was show.
Yeah. I want to check it out. There's this show in German, Dark was quite yep. big, all German. I watched that, loved it. So like really it really, I do feel like with Netflix, with the Academy, Oscar's so white, like opening up to mm-hmm. Subtitled movies, it is opening the door to film and TV from anywhere being a smash hit globally, because people mm-hmm. are going to become more and more open to reading subtitles, I hope and believe.
Mm-hmm.
And now a message from our sponsors.
This episode is brought to you by Linksys and Belkin. Upgrade your home into an office with professional-grade equipment today. Don't fight over the Wi-Fi anymore with Linksys Velop MX5300 AX Whole Home Wi-Fi 6 Mesh Router. Featuring 4 times more speed, range, and bandwidth than conventional routers, it'll make your current Wi-Fi feel like a dial-up. Better yet, never miss a call by ensuring that all of your devices are always fully charged and ready to go with Belkin Boost Charge USB-C and USB-A wall chargers. These chargers allow fast charging for up to 2 devices at a time. Stay charged and connected with Linksys and Belkin. Find out more at linksys.com/sg or belkin.com/sg.
And now for our top stories, and we start in Indonesia. An Indonesian influencer auctions virginity for COVID-19 aid, later apologizes for satirical stunt. So a popular Indonesian influencer, Sarah Kale, decided to auction her virginity to help people who are suffering from the pandemic. And then later on, after outrage, decided that, oh, I'm sorry, that's just a satire.
I don't know what she was thinking. Apparently she was doing it for the clout, most likely, which all these people do, right?
Yeah. I mean, she put it up at like 2 billion Indonesian rupiahs, which is roughly about 136,000 USD. So, I mean, that's quite a lot of money, but still, why would you even do this in this time when everyone's like so, you know, hurting and everything is more sensitive, everything is more heightened, and, you know, all these influencers are getting into trouble, not just in Indonesia, all over the place. Why would you even pull the stunt?
She probably gained a lot of followers and got a lot of coverage, but I don't know if, do you think... this is happening just more overall in Indonesia, or that we've just really on this beat in Indonesia, but it just seems like every week there's another influencer or YouTuber gone wild doing something as a stunt. They're definitely getting coverage every week out of it, at least from us. But no, I think it's very much covered in the local media as well.
Maybe because they, you know, can't go outside and take their, you know, bikini selfies. Like, this is what they have to resort to.
Yeah.
To try to get some attention. It's like, look at me, look at me. I'm still here. So
it worked.
It did work.
And over in Bangkok, The Terminal Bangkok Edition. Stranded Nigerians were living in the airport since March. So wow. Three Nigerian nationals living inside Bangkok Suvarnabhumi Airport nearly 2 months have been surviving on the generosity of airport employees. Mm. But yeah, these airport employees on Tuesday brought food and supplies to the three who have been unable to reach their destinations in Myanmar and Laos due to the lack of flights, or they would have to leave the airport without visas. And yeah, both flights were cancelled for the three men, along with most others due to the pandemic. And yeah, the Civil Aviation Authority of Thailand announced that it would extend the ban on international passenger flights until June 30th.
Wow.
Yeah.
So they're stuck another month at least.
Yeah, and yeah, I guess it's worth mentioning that the three travelers have been tested and do not have the virus. So
That's good. Where are they staying? Like, where are they, like, sleeping? Like, are there...
Did it say?
Like a lounge or something? That would be quite nice.
I have no idea. But yeah, I hope they're okay.
Yeah. I wonder if they're staying in an airport hotel or if they actually have to stay, just sleep rough on the benches. So they're at Suvarnabhumi Airport, which is Thailand, Bangkok's biggest airport, huge airport. Millions and millions and millions of people come through there every year. Yeah, there's definitely room for it to spread out. If there's no flights and not a lot of travel, which I think is the case. But yeah, kind of a heartwarming story that they're being helped. And poor guys, they've been stuck in the airport since March and they're not leaving at least till July. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, in Singapore, we had a big controversy, which is, this is such a Singaporean story, I have to say, where it's kind of much ado about nothing. But pretty funny, and I personally have a soft spot in my heart for otters, which is what this is about. Singapore has these native populations of, I think it's two species of otters, and I can't remember their exact names, but they're wild otters who I think were driven almost to extinction over the past few decades, but recently due to conservation efforts and actually, I think, caring about the otter population, they have had a bit of a resurgence. They're still definitely endangered and, you know, not by any means abundant. But what happened is that a pack of otters, these otters, they eat fish. And there's been a few instances like this where they break into somewhere and eat a bunch of fish. in this case, they broke into this, well, I don't know if it was like blocked, but they went into a actress's home, her backyard, and ate some of her koi fish, which were very valuable, and feasted on them, and just, they were gone.
All I'm hearing is that they have taste.
Yeah, absolutely. And this actually, there was a funny situation that was very similar in the last few years where they got into the Shangri-La Hotel, very fancy hotel in Sentosa, and ate, I remember, 80,000 Singapore dollars worth of koi fish. So they got in there and ate this lady's koi fish. And that was covered and was what it was. It had happened before. But then things escalated when a guy wrote an op-ed to the Straits Times, the biggest newspaper in Singapore, and basically said, otters need to stop infringing on human territory. Should we consider culling them? Fancy fish owners can't be blamed if they start to poison the otters, and maybe we should consider using air horns and rubber bullets to like keep them away from our koi fish. Which was just ridiculous. I was incensed, furious.
Yeah.
And unsurprisingly, so were a lot of animal rights folks, and it became this huge thing where there was lots of memes and comments of people saying, what the hell, otters should not be culled. There are some people saying, yes, otters are getting too bold and interacting with humans too much. We actually interviewed Otter Man, a guy called Otter Man, who's a biologist and a total otter expert. And he said, although increasing numbers of the adorable sea animals have sparked concerns about overpopulation, this expert says fears of them taking over the city are totally misplaced. He said that, let me see, what did he say? There's a natural limit to the number of animals living in a space. So there are territorial battles going on every day. Reproduction rates and cub survival may be poor when families are living in suboptimal conditions. So yeah, basically otters are nowhere near being culled, or that nowhere near where they should be culled. They are the fact that they're interacting with human population more is a sign that they are actually having healthy populations. And yeah, there was a big back and forth. One page admin of Otter City, an online community for people who love the otters, said, before you say cull the otters, why not go out after Circuit Breaker and find one of these otter families that are overrunning Singapore? Not that easy, you know. Watch a while and notice people breaking into smiles. Better yet, stop us for a chat. We may make an otter friend out of you yet. So, yeah, I think long story short, there will not be any culling of otters. I think the actress actually came out herself, whose fish were eaten, and said, no, I do not want otters killed. She never wanted otters to be killed. And for now, otters are safe, unless koi fish owners start poisoning them, which would be very infuriating.
Maybe just keep other fish.
Yeah, cheaper ones.
Yeah, cheaper fish.
Knowing full well they like the high class stuff, you know.
Yeah. I just like in my mind, I feel like it's like a heist. Like the otters like plant this, and then they jumped in, ate all the koi fish, and then like left in the middle of the night, you know? Like
totally.
I like to think about that. They're really cute though. Like, I mean, I don't think anyone can see an otter and be like, that's a dick. Or
they're awesome.
Oops, sorry.
You otter. Oh no, it's totally fine. Yeah, it's bizarre. I mean, I'm pretty sure the guy who wrote the op-ed like owns an aquarium business. So he's very much in the pro exotic fish lobby. And no issues with having exotic fish, but you know, some of these fish are tens of thousands of dollars. They're like $50,000. So that's why some people are getting really upset. But it's like if you're gonna spend $50,000 on a fish, put up some fucking fences around your enclosure because this is otter zone, baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And now to Bali. Travelers entering Bali via Negara Rai International Airport need to undergo swab tests. So basically anyone who's entering Bali now via the airport or Benoa port will undergo a swab test to find out whether they have COVID-19. I think, you know, in the last month or so, they've been slowly letting people back in to Bali. So all these people are now, if you enter Bali now, you have to do a swab test.
Yeah, it's that's intense because swab tests are supposed to be not very fun. They really stick the swab way down the back of your throat, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, I think like some places have said that they can't legally do that. I was reading somewhere, I need to clarify where, but because of the DNA collection that you could do and all that, like identity stuff. But like, I mean, I don't think, you know, there's nothing nefarious here. I think they just want to make sure that you know, no one with COVID-19 will enter Bali. But that is a pretty, pretty difficult test to take, you know? Invasive, really. But I guess, you know, to make sure that everyone's safe and healthy, that's probably the best way.
Makes your fun trip to Bali a little bit more daunting when you when you know that's going to happen upon entry.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I guess they didn't give like a timeline for how long they're going to do this yet, but we'll have to see whether that's going to, you know, sort of dissuade people from going to Bali. In any way, like, I think most people that are entering now are returning migrant workers locals who are just returning home because they were stuck somewhere else. So, hopefully everyone's safe and, you know, the swab test doesn't, keep people away.
Yeah, I don't think there's any international flights going into Bali, but there are some domestic flights and travel happening within Indonesia, so it must be that. But probably, I would imagine they're going to continue this for the foreseeable future because, everybody, everywhere, obviously, is being very careful about COVID.
Absolutely.
And now we're back to talking about animals. Over in Manila, reporter Doris Begonia powers through as scene-stealing catfight ensues during her live interview. Yeah, gather around, cool kittens. All you cool cats and kittens. I just had to.
Yes, yeah, the veteran, obligatory.
I had to, you know. But yeah, the veteran journalist looked unfazed, or at the very least tried to keep it together during her live interview, just as two of her scene-stealing cats launched into an on-screen scuffle. Social media, on the other hand, was all too pleased about it. But yeah, Begonia was talking to Ayala Land Mall's president on ABS-CBN's digital show about the quarantine guidelines, just as Metro Manila transitioned into the modified enhanced community quarantine. But yeah, it's long and wordy, but necessary, of course. But you're forgiven if you're not paying attention to what's being said, especially after a smoky tabby and a fluffy white feline aggressively launched into a fight right behind her, pawing out spirited slaps left and right.
Cat fight!
But yeah, the cats were fighting and then they tumbled off of the bookcase and off the screen. Just please watch the video.
Yeah, it was hilarious. Mm-hmm. Hilarious.
Yeah, and her expression.
It's one you gotta watch, made for viral internet fame. Mm-hmm. I actually haven't watched the full thing. What was her expression? She just kind of like kept trying to hold the interview, right?
Yep, she just looked like deadpan. It was beautiful.
Yeah. She generally looks annoyed anyway. Like, I feel like she always looks very frown. So just like, you know, but I guess like that's what reporters have to be, right? Like, they always have to focus on the story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just look at me and ignore this violent cat fight that is happening behind me with nails and fur flying. Anyway, moving on to Hong Kong, where our top story is a bit more serious. And actually, there's been even more developments last night. But in this past week, Hong Kong police banned the annual march commemorating the Tiananmen Square massacre, basically citing public health concerns due to COVID-19. They said that the march, which would take place on June 4th, as it does every year, would violate the current ban on gatherings of over 8 people. So more recently, last night, it was just basically announced that the Beijing central government of China would be taking a lot more control of Hong Kong. I'm not knowledgeable enough about Hong Kong and Chinese law to explain exactly what they decreed, but it was basically a decree that many are saying is the death of the one country, two systems situation, where Hong Kong does have a large degree of autonomy and rule of law and freedom of speech. So this is something which we'll continue to cover. And unfortunate news from Hong Kong, where it does just seem to be that Hong Kong's unique legal situation is kind of fading away and it's becoming more and more a part of China. Yeah, no, a tough one to make commentary on. For our feature interview this week on the Coconuts podcast, we are going to listen to an excerpt from one of our recent Coco chats between Shani, Coconuts Bali managing editor, and Kai Mata, an Indonesian singer-songwriter. They spoke about being openly queer in Indonesia. Give it a listen.
So for everyone who's just joined us, I'm Shani. I'm the managing editor of Coconuts Bali. And today we are joined in Coco Chats with Kai Mata, who is a Bali-based Indonesian musician and is also an openly queer Indonesian. And for those of you who don't know, being openly queer in Indonesia is something that you could label as crazy brave. I think some people have actually said that about Kai. I mean, homosexuality is not actually a crime here in Indonesia, but LGBT people have been targeted by extremists and hardline groups, and they've been, you know, on the receiving end of discrimination over the years. So I actually came across Kai because of a video that you did. I think it was earlier this year. Is that right?
It was probably at the end of February.
Okay, yeah, it was on the Family Resilience Bill, which is a hugely controversial bill here in Indonesia that contains many, many problematic articles. But one of it is because it actually requires LGBT people to report to authorities for rehabilitation, which is just kind of insane. But yeah, I kind of want to start off our conversation today by asking you, like, what prompted you to make that video and being, like, openly out?
Good question. It's a long history of recognizing that I want to stay in Indonesia and be openly queer here. It's a big part of my identity, both being Indonesian and being queer. And I want both of them to be embraced in my country. We have been a community that has been hidden in the shadows as of lately, as of the 21st century, by all these laws and all this discrimination attacking this community group. And that's why a lot of us are silent. I am privileged with accepting family, and I am privileged with an audience that easier allows me to be out and open and to be brave in the face of this adversity compared to most Indonesians in this circumstance. And that is what propelled me and motivated me forward to come out publicly on a global scale of announcing that.
Mm-hmm. So when you made that video, did you have any expectation of how it was going to be perceived? Because for those of you who don't know, the video pretty much went viral, and a lot of people, you know, started sharing it all over, because it's a really important issue that needs to have, you know, a platform so that people can petition against it and be aware that it exists. And so how has that experience been like?
So when I heard about the Family Resilience Bill, I made a 20-minute video. It was just me ranting at a camera for 20 minutes, and I cried. I was a blubbering mess. And then I edited it, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is terrible. And I only took that 15-second clip of me being like, hi, I'm Kaimata, I'm Indonesian, and I'm gay. That's the only thing that was of worthwhile value to me. And I published that. I posted it on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. My Twitter account had probably 100 followers, yet it somehow reached 400,000 people, over 400,000 people. It was unexpected. I didn't think it would go that far. And I'm shocked still that a simple statement of me just announcing that I'm LGBTQ+ and Indonesian was so noteworthy and so newsworthy in Indonesia. That shows how rare it is to even be open about this, which is something I think should be normalized and something that should just be accepted.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I have so many friends who are LGBT, and, you know, they're afraid of being out, even among, like, their closest peers. They really pick and choose who they, you know, reveal their sexuality to. And, like, now that you have this platform and this public recognition, I would say, what do you hope to achieve with that?
There are three different things I want to achieve on different realms. From the realms of focusing on the LGBTQ+ community in Indonesia, I want to make sure that there's representation and visibility so that LGBTQ+ youth especially don't feel like they're alone. I remember growing up and being a teenager in Jakarta and not knowing anyone that was gay, not knowing anyone that was LGBTQ. It was frightening to feel so isolated and vulnerable in that regard, where I didn't know of anyone I could speak to or anyone I could see in the news, the media, or anything. So from the aspect of the LGBTQ+ community, I think it's really important to have visibility. From the aspect of the rest of Indonesia, I want to put a face to a group, because a lot of the times I think it's a lot easier to demonize us when they don't see us as human. Okay. Yes, I am LGBTQ. Yes, I have a female partner, but there are other aspects about me. Mm-hmm. I'm a human just like them. I'm complex. I cry. I watch trashy TV shows. I really love martabak. You know, there's things that make me human just as much as they are.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, I love martabak too, by the way, so I can relate.
Thank you. Yes.
And how's it been so far? Like, I'm sure you receive a lot of backlash too, because, like, the online community can be really difficult sometimes. And how have you been handling that?
It comes in waves, you know. I think this week has been especially hard. Every morning for the last few days, I've received an influx of messages, probably around like 300-400 a day. Death threats, people telling me that I should be stoned, that they want to kill me, that I should get the F out of Indonesia and should just leave, that my country doesn't accept this, that I'm trying to bring Western values into Indonesia, which is so misinformed and so ignorant. And that's really heavy. I will be honest and say that that gets hard to deal with, especially feeling hundreds of people of my own people, my own Indonesian citizens, telling me to leave and that they don't want me here, that they want me either kicked out, cured, or killed. But I continue going on because I recognize that Indonesia needs visibility, that I have the opportunity to be visible, and I need to hold myself responsible to do something about that, because this is my country and I'm here to stay.
Mm-hmm. I'm so sorry that you've been on the receiving end of all that, but I have seen also a lot of support, and I hope that's been somewhat helpful for you as well.
Definitely. It's super inspiring and motivating when people, especially Indonesians who are in the LGBTQ plus community, write me and tell me that they never thought an Indonesian could ever come out, and that they are so happy to hear Indonesian music that represents this part of their identity, their sexual orientation, their gender identity. And that's really what helps keep me going.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I noticed about like your music and also your activism is that you primarily communicate with your audience in English, right? So I think maybe a lot of people actually mistook you for being foreign. Do you think that's the case?
Yeah, of course. A good slew of my comments are not just homophobic, but they're also racist. They're very anti-Chinese sentiment. I'm Chinese Indonesian.
Yeah.
That explains the accent, because I was born in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yes, so I was born a little bit before May 1998, which we all know in Indonesian history was a rough time for my ethnic background.
Mm-hmm.
And from that aspect, I speak in English because I want to firstly protect myself a little bit. If I spoke in Indonesian, I would open myself up to a lot more hate, while mm-hmm. also closing myself up from the international community, which is a significant community to rely on. Not to be dependent on, but to ask for help and support. A lot of the comments that come from outside are more supportive, and mm-hmm. I want Indonesians to see that there is support, even if it's not in Indonesia.
Okay.
And it also attracts Indonesians who, I would say, if they can speak English and understand my message, there's a higher chance that they are more tolerant and more accepting of LGBTQ plus people.
All right. Okay, so we have a question here from Andra, and he's asking, how important is a supportive family been in getting you through your daily struggles?
Daily struggles? The only reason I feel brave enough to come out in Indonesia is because I know I have a supportive family. My partner goes on Christmas vacations with us. She's integrated into our life. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is so rare in Indonesia. I am very blessed with a mom and dad who love me regardless of all of my choosings. On a day-to-day basis, they don't know about what I do on a day-to-day basis with LGBTQ plus activism, but it's that overarching support that really has allowed me to feel the courage and the strength to do what I do.
Because you're part of the movement now, maybe you're talking with our activists on how to reach out to more people and all that kind of things, or maybe you're thinking about ideas right now that could potentially support more LGBTQ Indonesians.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. It's been a shift, especially with the COVID-19 pandemic and how we're all meant to stay home.
Mm-hmm.
When I play concerts, I make sure everyone knows that my shows are LGBTQ plus friendly and LGBTQ plus encouraged. Mm-hmm. I live in Bali, and I want to make sure that it's a safe space for LGBTQ plus travelers, LGBTQ plus expats, and LGBTQ plus locals to be able to meet in an environment where they can foster friendships and create a bond of camaraderie. What was happening now is moving things online, which of course poses its own risks. For example, it being a digital footprint of LGBTQ plus existence. And a lot of people are scared about that, especially with how the government and sometimes the police use other laws to discriminate against our community, even though homosexuality isn't criminalized in Indonesia.
Yeah.
But we use whatever excuse we can to prosecute us. So from that way, it's something that we have to handle very delicately, something we have to handle with sensitivity.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So you mentioned about being based in Bali, right?
Yeah.
Do you think that particular, because Bali is I think we can all generalize a little bit there and say that Bali is a more tolerant place. There's just there's also a lot of foreigners there and a lot of people who I would think would be more supportive of the LGBTQ cause. And I think has that sort of like played a key difference for you in finding the spaces where you can talk about your identity but and, you know, deliver your message? And do you think it will be different if you were to, say, do that in Jakarta or other cities in Indonesia?
I'd be way too scared to be based in Jakarta. Definitely. Okay. No, yes. Yeah. Bali is, I would say, the most tolerant city in Indonesia, or sorry, the island in Indonesia. But that being said, we still face a lot of problems here. Like, in the beginning of the year, a lot of villas were raided, first being suspected to be advertised for LGBTQ plus travelers. Mm-hmm. And they were raided and shut down. Mm-hmm. We also recognize that a lot of the Balinese who are LGBTQ plus don't come out. The Indonesians that are here that are a little more open about their sexual orientation are from Java, from Sumatra, other parts of the island. It's mm-hmm. And I think a big part of that is the idea of the shame you bring to your family. We're a collectivistic country. Mm-hmm. So it's so difficult because me coming out affects my parents and affects the way my parents' friends view them, affects the way that their religious organizations view them, affects everything like that. And it's this idea that we don't want to bring shame upon our family. Yeah. That being said, Bali does have a lot of things working in its favor to be more tolerant, mm-hmm. but we're not accepted. It's hush, hush. Don't ask, don't tell.
Yeah. It's like this weird kind of, I don't know, acceptance, but that it's not really acceptance. And I think we see that a lot because people are, sometimes they would be open about being who they are, but they wouldn't say it explicitly. I think I find that a lot in like just among my friends, really. And here we have a question from Ron Winston. Have you ever faced legal or criminal repercussions, or is that an issue that you worry about?
It is an issue I worry about, and which is why I have I consult a legal team with how I word things, especially digitally, especially written proof. That's a really good question. I am worried about that, and I make sure to take the proper precautions as much as I can, because they are going to use any law they yeah. possibly could find to criminalize me if they wanted to. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm.
And how exactly have you been using your music to extend your message to the larger community?
For me, music has always been my modality to convey my emotions. Mm-hmm. It is a way where I think I can create a connection with another person. So when someone listens to it, regardless of their sexual orientation, I think it is a way I can deliver my experience into a way they understand and can empathize with. And then also I can empathize with their experience too. From that regard, I would say it's a bridge to be able to cross over and allow people to relate, because people don't have the same experiences. No one has the same life, but we all share a similar experience of what emotions feel like. We've all felt grief. We've all felt like we are alone. We've all felt the peaks of happiness, the peaks of falling in love. And when we can relate on those emotions, I think that's when we can foster a commonality between the two of us.
Yeah. Yeah, I think like I always talk about this, like it's about multidimensionality, right? Everybody is multidimensional. We're not, you can't just assume that we're so-and-so based on how we look. And I always love that about, I think that's one of the key messages that I see too across the activism in LGBTQ communities or even like for any minority groups, really, to understand that we're more than what we appear to look like and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And so we have another question here from user Look At My Back. I don't know. But he or she is asking about your coming out story. Is that something that you want to talk about in Coco Chats?
Sure, let's do it.
All right. So what was it like?
I mean, every day I come out. It's not something that's just happened once.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that happens on a recurring basis.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the first person I told physically with my words what happened when I was a teenager in Jakarta, and it was scary and frightening and vulnerable, and to be met with, I guess, a sense of I've said this, so I own this word, it's real, hit me. And then from there I started telling more people, And I came out to my parents, like, fully when I was in a relationship with a woman. And we had been living together for 3 months already. And I was like, hey, I'm living with this girl. She's my girlfriend. And they said so very sweetly, as long as you are happy, we're happy. And that is all they needed to say.
That is so nice. Kudos to your parents, honestly.
I know.
Yeah.
That is all they needed to say. From the aspect of coming out publicly in Indonesia, I would say I made a very big mark last year in June for Pride Month when I released my first very lesbian song, which is all about the weird and ridiculous questions people ask me as someone who is in a relationship with a woman about whether or not we're open to having a threesome with a man, whether or not that they men can turn me straight because, you know, they are somehow going to be the magic cure to my gayness.
Oh, dear.
And other things like that. So I would say that every day I come out, and of course, you know me because of something I did in February, which a lot of people also say was me coming out publicly in Indonesia.
Right, yeah.
Which is another aspect of there's always people I have to speak and new people I need to share with my identity on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is like our challenge here in Indonesia in, you know, fighting this discrimination against the LGBTQ community? Like, you spoke about sending like messages of hope and stuff, and I think that's also really important. But if you, if there's a specific difficulty in which you, you know, that we need to sort of address as a collective, as people who support LGBT and who identify as them, what do you think that is?
Indonesia is in a weird history where we've been so divided and love to attack people that are not like us. There's a sense of we need to all be the same in order to get along.
Right.
And we've noticed that with religious tensions, with political tensions, socioeconomic disparity, as well as human rights issues, such as the movement towards feminism and gender equality and LGBTQ plus rights. I think Indonesia, there are people that benefit from dividing us because when we attack other people, those in power remain in power and can use that as a political ploy. I think we just need to learn how to empathize and relate to others in, as individuals, as a collective group, because we are 17,000 islands. We are thousands of cultures. We are hundreds of languages united in our diversity. That is part of what makes Indonesia a very beautiful, inspiring place. Yet we're using that as a disadvantage to fight each other and pull each other down rather than rise above and celebrate this diversity that is so beautiful. We're tied together by the collective love of spice and this vibrancy in that regards. And we should be able to get back to that because that was something that was ingrained in our culture, ingrained in our history, that has been wiped away within the last 20 years.
Yeah. If you guys haven't listened to Kai Mata, Google her, you go to her YouTube, go to her Instagram and check her out. Now that you're basically, I feel like if people were to see you on the street, you would get recognized and all that stuff. Have you actually experienced anything, hopefully not, but I don't know, negative, but just by being out, like on the streets instead of like online?
Sometimes.
In Bali?
Yeah. Yes. It's difficult. There was one time where I was stopped by the police 3 times on the same road. First one to check my ID because I look 14 and I don't look Indonesian. So they think they're going to be able to shake me down for money. And I passed and they begrudgingly let me go. But then 100 meters away, police came, took photos of my ID, took photos of my bike and took photos of everything. And they said, they addressed me as Hai Kai Mata, which was weird because it's like they knew me, they expected me. And that was a frightening thing to see that being done by the law, by the group that is meant to protect Indonesian citizens. Also, when I play shows, I played a really big show. It was probably around 10,000 people. It was one of the biggest shows, concerts, festivals I've played. And I always announce that I'm gay. And I always announce and make it visibly known. And this was an audience that was majority Indonesian.
Okay.
And I walked down and people were cheering, but I also got groped a lot of times. And I don't know if that's because I was just a woman or because I was an LGBTQ plus woman. I have no idea. But it was just men taking photos of me, which I and also touching places that I would say aren't very friendly to touch.
Yes. God. So sorry you have to go through that. People, man.
People, right? Yeah.
Yeah, honestly. And so what's your goals now, like in terms of your both music and activism? Because I think those two are intertwined really closely. So
very much so.
Yeah. So what's your plan? And what are you like? I mean, obviously, our life is a bit on hold because of COVID-19. But afterwards, what's your goals and stuff?
Yes, life has shifted. And I'm using this time to try to be as adaptive as possible to the current circumstances. My goals for 2020 are to make sure that the world knows about what is going on in Indonesia. We are a powerful country. We are the fourth largest population in the world. And we are a massive influence in the economic scale with a growing middle class as we're rising from developing to developed country. And we need to make sure that we protect our citizens. Our history is being erased, and Indonesia used to be such a tolerant place, so accepting. We have a long-standing culture and history of waria, which is a third gender or kind of transgender, and we're pretending like that doesn't exist, even though it's ingrained in the batik that we've woven for centuries. I want to make sure that we can celebrate that and recognize that we are a country that can only be stronger if we learn to respect each other as individual humans rather than look and tear each other down and point the finger at who's more of an animal.
Thank you so much, Kai. This has been so insightful. And thank you so much for everyone who's joined us. So you can all find Kaimada through her handle, Kaimada Music. And so we're actually going to be having an article on Kai soon. So stay tuned for that on Coconuts. And so I just want to wish you all a good afternoon. Thank you again, Kai, for sitting down with us on Coco Chats.
Thank you so very much for having me. It's such an honor.
Until next time, you guys.
Yes. Bye. Thank you for having me.
Bye, everyone.
Now you can wear your love of coconuts proudly across your chest. That's right, we've launched our very own merchandise line with that ultimate wardrobe mainstay, the white t-shirt. Our unisex coconuts logo tee is simple and stylish with a classic fit, and it's a versatile everyday tee that you can rock, whether you're getting some goodies at 7-Eleven or getting ready for a night out on the town. The coconuts logo tee can be bought exclusively on Teespring, and we're offering it for 25% off at $19.99 USD until the end of May, and that's off the usual price of $26.99 USD. Represent coconuts and our weird and wondrous stories from Asia. Buy it now by going to coconuts.co or Googling coconuts logo tea.
Thanks for listening, guys. That's it for this week of the Coconuts podcast. Just a reminder that we always are looking for your support as readers, as listeners, as viewers. If you like the stories we tell, you can support Coconuts by becoming a Coco Plus member. Go to coconuts.co/membership, or you can make a patron payment at coconuts.co/patron. Also, we are selling our very cool, stylish, and comfy Coconuts brand logo white tees, which are 25% off until the end of May. Just go to coconuts.co and you'll see a bunch of ads for them. Get yours and be sure to tag us on Instagram if you're gonna wear your swag. So that's it for this week, guys. Talk to you next week, and thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Later. The Coconuts Podcast is a Coconuts Media production. Our hosts are Byron Perry, Vim Shanmugam, and Summer Lee. Our production manager is Clarissa Cortez.